My name is Seth Zariak, and I'm one of the co-editors of this volume, and I wish to welcome you and thank you for coming tonight to our conversation about the book. And it is my great pleasure and to welcome also two commentators, very dear friends and distinguished scholars, Arne Westa, the S.T. Lee Professor of American and Chinese Relations at Harvard, and Veselin Dimitrov, the reader in the government department here at the LSE, both distinguished Cold War scholars and also scholars of the Balkans, in case of Veselin Dimitrov. I also wish to welcome here to London my dear friends, co-editors, Konstantina Botziu from the Karamanlis Institute, director of the Karamanlis Institute in Athens, and Evantis Hadjivasiliou from the University of Athens. My dear friends, and one of the biggest achievements beside this, what is in front of you, is that we remain friends after all these years, yes, which is, believe me, a very, very daunting and difficult task. And I was really fortunate and honored and privileged to work with these people. At the same time, I have to say that how sorry we are that Irini Karamuzi, the fourth co-editor of this volume, is not with us due to the family emergency, and wish this way to say thank you to her for her contribution, valuable contribution to the series. The way we have envisaged this evening is for Sir Vestad and Veselin Dimitrov to say a few things about the book. Sir Vestad also contributed with a conclusion to this volume, which made it even more valuable on the Balkans from a much wider global perspective. After that, the three of us will say a few words, but we'll try to be as short as possible, in order to allow time for the questions from you. I also, at the beginning, wish to thank fantastic people from LSE Ideas, Adriana, Joseph, Bastian, who made this possible and organized this impeccably, as always. Thank you very much once again. So, without further ado, I will ask Professor Westad to say a few words, and then your friend, Veselin Dimitrov.
Well, thank you very much, Sveta. I probably don't need a microphone. I'm not even sure if it's on. Anyway, it's wonderful to be back at LSE Ideas. I was back at LSE giving a lecture here on Tuesday, but this is the first time I'm actually back in Ideas since I stepped down as director 2 years ago. And it's particularly nice to be back for this kind of occasion, because doing the kind of research that goes into this book is very much what LSE Ideas was about when we first set it up and what it has remained. So this is an attempt, really, not just that the book is, not just an attempt at understanding, as the title says, the Balkans in the Cold War. It is very much an attempt, I think, to try to understand how the Balkan region in its contemporary form was created, right? And that's very much what LSE Ideas is about as well. It started out as a group of mainly historians, or qualitatively oriented sociologists, political scientists, who wanted to understand how the Cold War as an international system created the time that we live in. And then it became so much more after a while. But that was the starting point for it when we set it up. And the kind of book that we're looking at here is a very good example of what can come out of that kind of research. And I want to congratulate the editors on putting together a really, really fascinating volume. I mean, there's not it's not often that I have the chance, particularly in terms of time, to contribute some of my own work to a volume, particularly not mainly, sort of, or primarily within my own fields of expertise. But this one was so interesting that I was very, very eager to do so. So I'm just going to talk very briefly tonight about some of the points that I make in the conclusion or the afterword to the book, just throw out a few ideas which I think would be interesting to discuss, and then of course you will hear from Evantis and from Konstantina and from Sveta, and right after I speak from Veselin as well, who it's really good to see again, by the way, one of my favorite colleagues at LSE. So on this, I think, to me, what is most important about the book is that it explains both the significance of the global Cold War to the Balkans, but it also explains, or at least it poses a whole set of very valuable questions about why the Cold War in the Balkans was different from what you saw elsewhere. So it's in a way trying to do both things. It's trying to take a fairly broad field of research and apply that to the Balkans, but it's also trying to set out some of the reasons why the Cold War was different in that region. And that's why I've called my afterword to the book, The Balkans, A Cold War Mystery. So what is it that is mysterious about it, if we start with it? Now, the biggest surprise is, of course, that if you look at the way the Balkans had developed in 1945, 46, 47, the region seemed to be heading for a kind of rather stable Cold War system, right? There was the Greek Civil War that was ongoing and was still uncertain in terms of its final outcome. But overall, in terms of great power involvement, you know, the Balkans region broke down quite nicely in terms of the ideological contradictions that existed at the European level and at the global, the creation phase of the global Cold War. And then in the late 1940s, it moves in a very different direction. First and foremost, of course, because of the Soviet-Yugoslav split that almost no one could have foreseen in 1945 or even 1946. Yugoslavia, the Yugoslav communist movement were in many ways, and I think quite rightly, seen as the Soviets' closest ally in Eastern Europe. I mean, the movement that was most aligned with Soviet aims and Soviet motives, particularly in terms of how the Yugoslav communists envisaged the development model that they wanted to put in place in Yugoslavia after they had won the war and the civil war that went on within it. The break between the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia obviously opened up for a very different kind, much more complicated, complex kind of Cold War development in the Balkans. But of course, it didn't stop there in terms of maverickdom and complexity. So on the eastern side, Romania stayed within the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact, but became an outlier on most issues, increasingly so when you get into the 1970s and 1980s, right? So within the Warsaw Pact, but not actually of it, often taking positions that were completely at odds with where the Soviets wanted to do. And that relationship, I would venture, had its own logic. I mean, it wasn't really connected to the Soviet-Yugoslav rivalry in any meaningful way. It was about the domestic direction chosen in Romania. And then, of course, the relationship between Greece and Turkey. Now, I do make the point that it's not unique in Cold War terms, in the sense that it often happens that regional rivals, which Turkey and Greece certainly has been since coming out of the 19th century, find their way into the same alliance. Now, that happens elsewhere as well. What is unique about the Turkish and Greek membership in NATO is how elites within both countries tried to make use of this for their domestic purposes and succeeded to quite some extent in doing that in a situation where the two countries had several episodes of very high tensions between them. Now, it's that kind of development that is unique in Cold War terms with the Balkans, not least if you think about the Cyprus conflict, which I'm actually very interested in, but won't have time to get into in my comments today. So this is in a way why the Cold War and its effects in the Balkans is a bit of a mystery. It seems to produce a heterodox approach to international affairs, and conformity to some extent at the same time, at least in alliance terms. And that's not something that you find in many of these settings. If you think about the Cold War in an overall European context, you don't find all that much of that, including countries that regarded themselves as being neutral. Now, I just want to leave you with one other thought with regard to this, which I found interesting in a sort of broad sense. And that is, you know, how key concepts of development, of industrial technological development, are connected with Cold War events in the Balkans. And that's something which I think the whole Cold War studies literature has become increasingly preoccupied with. And one of the great things in this volume is that development is so well represented. Now, what's interesting here is that when you think about the way the Cold War ended, it was in fact the countries that seemed to set up some kind of relationship with the United States, Greece and Turkey, although in very different ways, and of course after 1981, Greece's relationship with the European Union, that seemed to be able to benefit from the way in which the Cold War itself ended. While the countries that had developed, even the maverick countries that had been outside of the alliance, seemed to decline rather precipitously, and of course with catastrophic results in the case of Yugoslavia, leading to the Yugoslav civil wars. Well, maybe this is not so surprising when you think about it in an all-European context, right? But it is slightly surprising in the Balkan context, because what it means is that it's the political events of the late 20th century that in a way comes to predominate in terms of development style, development futures, economic revolutions. I mean, think about Greece, which in many ways is so far, many Greeks today would disagree with me, but I would still venture to say this, one of the ultimate beneficiaries of how all of this ended up. In 1950, Bulgaria's GDP per capita GDP was roughly at the level of Bulgaria's. And if you think about the sea change that has taken place since then, it is actually quite remarkable. But mentioning Bulgaria is also interesting here, because Bulgaria was one of those countries, starting from a very, very low starting point, that seems to me, at least in a comparative sense, to benefit, probably the only country that did, benefit from its association within the Eastern Bloc and with the Soviet Union in development terms. Right? So that's another of the mysteries that come across here. If you were Bulgarian, and you saw this from the perspective of all of the 20th century, then in a way, having a system that was adopted from the Soviet system of strict centralization and the pooling of resources in order to push development in a rapid direction forward made at least some sense. I mean, it made no sense at all for Poland, even less sense for Czechoslovakia or Hungary. That would be seen as taking a step back in a way through its association with Soviet models of planning. For Bulgaria, and I think some of the post-Cold War experiences in that country show this, this may actually, in a development sense, I'm not arguing in a political sense, but in a development sense, have been of some value, although much below what Greece benefited from in its association with the United States and the European Union. So those are just the thoughts that I wanted to leave you with in terms of the effects of the Cold War in the Balkans, and I hope so that we can have a little bit of time, you know, when we dealt with this era in itself, also to talk about the contemporary implications that this has for the area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Helen?
Well, I would like to start by saying that the volume that we are launching tonight makes a substantial contribution to our understanding of the Cold War. Indeed, it is unusual for a volume of 15 authors to come together in such a wonderful way and make a real impact. I think there are at least five contributions that the volume makes to our understanding of the Cold War. Firstly, and most fundamentally, this is the first work that we have on the Balkans in the Cold War. There have been some excellent studies of individual countries, but this is the first attempt to consider the Balkans as a region in the Cold War. The fact that it looks not only at the impact of the superpowers on the Balkans, but also at the role that the Balkan states have played in the Cold War, is also a major plus. The focus in the volume on the interaction between the local, regional, and global levels is very much in sync with some of the most innovative and creative perspectives in the historiography of the Cold War. A second important contribution is that the volume develops a wide-ranging conceptual framework. It doesn't just look at traditional diplomatic history, it also looks at culture and identity. Thirdly, and very importantly, the volume draws together some of the most prominent scholars working in this field from a number of countries in the region as well as from outside the Balkans. This makes it possible to offer not only an excellent perspective on the state of current research on the Balkans, but it also provides wonderful avenues for cross-fertilization, comparison, and innovative interpretations. In fourth place, the volume is based on multi-archival research. And what is particularly interesting is that it is based on research in the regional archives, which have become available since the end of the Cold War. Finally, but very importantly, the volume is written in a wonderful style. It manages to convey sophisticated and substantive ideas in a clear and flowing and highly readable narrative. I'm sure that this is mostly to the credit of the authors, but in this case, I think the role of the editors was also of crucial importance. So I would particularly like to commend the editors for the splendid work they have done. So, what is the picture of the Balkans in the Cold War that emerges from this volume? To start with, it seems that the Balkans were wonderfully creative in the Cold War. In the Balkans, we can find virtually all conceivable and some inconceivable positions that small states could adopt in the global conflict. Just to give you a sense of the wonderful diversity that we have, first of all, we have states that make a virtue of their loyalty to the superpower and to the multilateral organizations of which they form part. Bulgaria is the most clear-cut case with its loyalty to the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, and the CMEA, the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance. On the other side of the Iron Curtain, Turkey was also mostly loyal to the Western Alliance with some significant interludes. We then come to the Mavericks, states that engaged in petulant and fractious behavior without, however, entirely cutting the strings to their superpower. Here we can point to Romania and on the other side, Greece, especially in the 1970s and the 1980s. We then come to a state that kept to a position of non-alignment with respect to the superpowers, and it managed to sustain that for decades, which was rather an impressive feat. And indeed, as Svetu Zarajak points in his chapter, created the non-aligned movement on a global scale. And that, of course, is Yugoslavia. And finally, to add a bit more flavor, we have the smallest and the poorest state in the region, Albania, which nevertheless rejected both superpowers and finally even managed to quarrel with China. So I don't think there is any other region in Europe or indeed the world in which we can find such a diversity of geopolitical positions and relationships. In that sense, the Balkans were a remarkably rich microcosm of the Cold War. Secondly, we could say that in many respects, the Cold War was a golden period for the Balkans. Of course, to start with, we had the disruptions stemming from the Second World War, the Tito-Stalin split, the Greek Civil War. But once those had been overcome by the early 50s, there followed nearly three decades of remarkable economic growth and social and cultural transformation. Indeed, we could say that it was in those decades that the Balkans entered the era of modernity. So for them, this was the critical turning point. Now, of course, the United States and the Soviet Union promoted different modernization projects, as well as different kinds of economic support to their clients. But for all the Balkan states, those modernization projects offered by the superpowers presented a unique opportunity to escape from the backwardness that had plagued them for centuries. In political terms, the impact of the Cold War was also positive in many respects. What we see during the Cold War across the Balkans, and for the first time in modern history, is the development of powerful, authoritative nation states, which provided their citizens with unprecedented levels of security, affluence, and social welfare. The Cold War also made it possible to restrain nationalist conflicts within states and between states. And those conflicts had been endemic before the Cold War and unfortunately have also been rather prominent after the Cold War. So the Cold War stands out as a golden era of stability. Finally, an important and largely positive effect of the Cold War was the fact that for the first time in their history, the Balkan states were offered real opportunities for integration into multilateral organizations. Some of them were security-oriented, such as NATO and the Warsaw Pact. Some were economic, such as the EEC and NATO. Now, of course, the interaction between the Balkan states and those organizations was complex, dynamic, and often contradictory. But, on the whole, what comes out is that the Balkan states showed impressive skill and indeed sometimes self-restraint in utilizing the opportunities that the multilateral organizations offered them to enhance their security, limit conflict, and advance their economic development. I'd like to end by mentioning some important questions that can provide avenues for further research and innovative interpretations on the Balkans in the Cold War. The first question has to do with the very definition of the topic, the Balkans in the Cold War. The fundamental question here is, did the Balkans exist in the Cold War? And if they did, in what sense? Now, of course, the Balkans existed during the Cold War in a geographical sense, but did they exist as a meaningful subsystem of states? What emerges from the volume is that for every Balkan state, the relationship with the superpowers and with multilateral organizations was far more important, positively or negatively, than relationships with their neighbors. Even in the seemingly favorable climate of the 1970s, the attempt by the Balkan states to create what Effie Pedaglio calls micro-détente amongst themselves did not achieve much. And as Effie demonstrates very well in her chapter, this was not only because of the actions of the superpowers, but also because of the tendency of the region to fragment. If we look at the closing stages of the Cold War in the late 80s, when there was another window of opportunity for regional cooperation, we can see that once again the Balkan states did not become active players in relation to each other. So it seems that the overall effect of the Cold War was to fracture the Balkans. And that raises the question in what sense they could be considered to form a subsystem within the Cold War, or simply a collection of states that happen to have different relationships with the superpowers and happen to be in geographical proximity to each other. The second question that could be explored in more depth is why there was such a high degree of dissonance in the Cold War Balkans. Arne discusses that wonderfully in his concluding chapter. For me, it's still a puzzle. Why was there such dissonance? There could be a number of possible explanations. The most obvious one is that after the first decade of the Cold War, the region became of marginal importance to the superpowers, and therefore they were willing to tolerate maverick behavior there in a way that would be inconceivable in the crucial Central European theater. Another possible explanation is that nationalism in the Balkans was more virulent than elsewhere in Europe, but also more inconsistent and more vulnerable. A third possibility is that the Balkan states faced modernization challenges that were more severe than those faced by the states in Central Europe, such as the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland. And to make it worse, they had to address those challenges with more limited resources. Yep. Now, those two factors together would tend to produce tensions with the superpowers. Paradoxically, because the Balkan states, precisely because of the severity of their modernization challenges, had excessively high expectations towards the superpowers and indeed towards the multilateral organizations, but at the same time they had perhaps excessively exaggerated fears of what the superpowers and the multilateral organizations could do to them. So I think this kind of dynamics, what we could call it the teenage dynamics towards the adults, could create rather fractures and indeed unstable relationships and dissonance, which is precisely what we observe in the Balkans. The third question that could be explored in more depth is what was the long-term impact of the Cold War, especially in terms of the sustainability of modernization. Now, as I mentioned, the Balkan states experienced three golden decades of growth after the early 1950s. But it all seemed to come to a crushing end in the 1970s, as Constantine Botiu explores in her chapter. In some sense, the Balkan states have yet to reemerge from that dead end in which they found themselves in the 1970s. Now, Greece seemed to be, and indeed was, a partial exception due to its early accession to the European Union and then the Eurozone. But since 2008, it also seems to be mired into a permanent crisis. And it seems to be facing developmental challenges that are not, unfortunately, fundamentally different from those of some other states in the region. So the 1970s seem to be the turning point. Up to that, we have three decades of exceptional growth, much higher than the European average, much higher than in Central Europe. It brings the Balkan states into modernity, and then it all comes to an end. And now, nearly 40 years later, we are still there. So why was that? Why did the particular kind of modernization that was created by the Cold War in the Balkans prove to be especially difficult to sustain? This is very clear if we compare the Balkans to the former communist states in Central Europe. In those states, there was also substantial modernization under communism, perhaps not in Czechoslovakia, but certainly in Poland and Hungary, which were at least half agrarian before the Second World War. So there was substantial modernization after the Second World War in the Cold War decades, but this modernization has proved to be much more sustainable after 1989. So the question is why? Was there anything fundamentally different about the Balkans and the kind of modernization they had compared to countries in the same bloc? I think that these questions, and I'm sure many others, can provide avenues for new research and innovative interpretations of the Balkans during the Cold War. And I think that the volume that we have here tonight provides us with a wonderfully stimulating and substantive launch pad for this research. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vasily. Thank you. Now, floor to Constantina, one of the co-editors.
Thank you. Well, I feel blessed and privileged to be here on a Friday evening in front of this exquisite audience among exceptional colleagues, and I thank them very, very much from the bottom of my heart, Arne and Veselin, for coming here to present this tangible product of 5 or 6 years of work. The history of this book started when we organized a conference in Athens back in 2011, and all the people sitting on this panel helped to do that, to make that a reality. The success of that conference that was organized by LSEADS and the Karamanlis Institute for Democracy encouraged us to move ahead with a collective volume that now you see in front of you. The target, the aim of this book was, to paraphrase John Lewis Gaddis, to tell what we know now about the Balkans in the Cold War. We did not seek an historical narration of events, what happened and when it happened, because people already know that, but rather a historical narrative about the major links and conflicts among Balkan states and among them and the two superpowers during the Cold War. After all, as Arne Westad points out in his chapter, and he repeated it in his talk, the Cold War started in the Balkans in the first place. The region, through the Greek Civil War, provided the fire that burned the last bridges between the Soviet Union and the United States back in 1947, thus triggering the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan exactly 70 years ago. It was also the area that many strategists considered a potential war theater until well into the 1950s. After that first escalation of importance, as Veselin pointed out, the Balkans fell beyond Central and Eastern Europe and the Third World. They were not so important for the Cold War, after all, in the 60s and the 70s. But as a result of the early Cold War, as well as a result of regional history, the Balkans became a mosaic of governance models and geopolitical alliances. Third way, Yugoslavia, isolationist Albania, USSR faithful Bulgaria, neutrality seeking Romania, Kemalist Turkey, and democracy struggling Greece. A common characteristic of them all was the long-time national efforts to modernize, as they suffered from the distance from developed Europe. NATO, the Warsaw Pact, and non-alignment were offering, case by case, the security environment for modernization. Security towards international enemies, but also mainly sometimes against local rivals. And this is something that we try to show in this volume. The book shows how past conflicts and national identity loom large in the division of the Balkans among the various geopolitical options in the Cold War. Entering or creating, in the case of Yugoslavia, one of those alliances was a shield against disturbances from the neighbors and a confirmation of the Balkan identity of each country. I would say that Yugoslavia and Bulgaria had the strongest commitment to a Balkan identity, whereas Greece and Turkey, and perhaps this is a partial answer to the questions that you posed, Vasily, were the loosest Balkan identities, as they were firstly tied to the Mediterranean identity. And this perhaps shows that this geopolitical dissonance overshadowed similar problems of development and modernization within these countries, because they didn't feel Balkan countries, firstly, they felt the Mediterranean countries. That's why they had the connection with the UK and later on with the Americans. If we would like to pose a final question about the legacy of the Cold War in the region, we would say that definitely, like in Europe as a whole, a legacy is the long period of peace, the longest ever experienced in the Balkans.
Yes.
Second, modernization together with the feeling of belonging to the developed world. Mm-hmm. So this target was also successful. Third, institutionalized long-term connection with the world's most powerful alliances, not just ad hoc alliances before any war. In the beginning, it was divided between NATO and the Warsaw Pact, also non-aligned movement, but now NATO, the EC, the US, of course, are the main links. And fourth, the burden of complex, and this is a negative one, perhaps insoluble in a peace context, internal schisms, as we see today in Turkey, and as the case was in the beginning of the 1990s in Yugoslavia. So there are some internal schisms that don't have to do with modernization only, but with deeper issues that have to do with identity and nation building. So this book does not aim to show the Balkans as a region with internal coherence. I think it never was. But rather the opposite, as a geographical region where history preserves diversity and different, often conflicting, concepts of political and strategic orientation. And indeed, I totally agree with you, Vasily, it's a miniature of the balance of power in Europe, to use this old-fashioned and perhaps passé historical term, the balance of powers. Never was that so evident as in the aftermath of the Cold War. As Arno reminds us, the beginning of the end of the Cold War did not take place in the Balkans. It started elsewhere. It started in Poland, started in Eastern Europe. But the decadence of communism as a system of governance, as well as the decadence of struggling democracies like that of Greece and Turkey, was evident there in the region already in the 1970s and the 1980s, including Yugoslavia, of course. But unlike East and Central Europe, the failure of communism in the Balkans, communism of all national sorts, fueled a violent surge in the region after the so-called Velvet Resolution, where the aftermath was violent. The centrality of Yugoslavia and the mosaic of the Balkans is also a reason why this country appears so often in the chapters of this book. You will see when you read this book, and I hope you read this book, after this presentation, that Yugoslavia appears every now and then linked with other case studies of the region. Apart from all these issues, we also wanted to provide state-of-the-art research regarding the impact of NATO, the EEC, and the Warsaw Pact on national and regional paths during the Cold War. And we do hope that this project will prompt other researchers to answer Vasalin's questions and other questions that have been fertilized by research for this volume, and that will also pave the way to deeper exploration on the history of the post-Cold War period. I do not want to take more time regarding the content of the book, because I would like to preserve some mystery around it, so that will encourage people to read it and judge for themselves. I will just mention that we're better friends now than we used to be when we started this project, and I tried to count the emails that we exchanged. I think there are over 700 in the past 5-6 years. Lastly, I would like to thank Irini Karamuzi, who could not make it today to be here with us, Svetozar Ajak, and Evans Hadzivasiliou for the wonderful moments that we spent together preparing this book, and of course, Palgrave Macmillan and Springer for promoting the book today, Effie Pendaliou and John Young for embracing the project and the series. And of course, I would like to thank you for being here with us on this wonderful Friday evening. Thank you very much for appreciating this project.
Well, let me start also by thanking Palgrave Macmillan, Oliver, who is here to help us in this event, my co-editors and the authors for a wonderful experience, Arne and Vesselin for generously being here and for being so nice to us towards us about this book. Let me say again that this is not a book claiming to be a definite history of Cold War Balkans. I mean, it's definitely not that. In fact, I doubt whether it is possible at this moment to write a definite history of the Balkans in the Cold War. So as editors, we had two choices. Either to try to produce an overview of the Balkans in the Cold War, describing events and issues, and I think we all agreed to take the other option, to attempt, therefore, deep dives into the state-of-the-art research on the Balkans. And this is why there is such an emphasis on multi-archival research, multi-archival both in regional archives as well as in the archives of international organizations or in the major powers. So this inevitably means, and I have to admit this, that the book points to directions but does not tell the whole story. And I'm not very much upset with it. You see, my teachers, both in Greece and here at the LSE 30 years ago when I was studying here, my teachers taught me that the only books which tell the whole story are the fundamental books of the religions based on Revelation, but usually not books written or edited by historians. So let me make three points. What I got from this book. My first point is the Balkans, but perhaps you will find it self-evident, but the Balkans, the Balkan countries did not determine the Cold War. It is impossible for countries with such economic, social, and political characteristics, or to put it differently, with a certain measure of backwardness economically and socially, it is impossible for them to produce new ideologies or new methods of government. So the Balkan countries were, during the Cold War, and they still are, they are regime takers, they are not regime makers. It is very important, however, for them to take regimes and to try themselves through indigenous forces to implement them. My second point, that this is a central question. I mean, this is the whole the question around which the book was built. How did the Cold War interact with regional realities? And in our case, our test case is the Balkans. Mm-hmm. But perhaps we can even attempt generalizations regarding this. Now, until very recently, the idea was that there are the Balkan client states and the superpower patrons. The picture that comes from this book, and I think we all knew that it would be like that, is that the situation is much more complicated than that. There is an interaction. There's a two-way traffic between them, although, of course, the importance of the superpowers is cannot be disputed. And let me say that working on this book, I'm thinking about trying to introduce a new concept. We all know about this concept about the Cold War lens through which the superpowers see especially minor partners or the Third World. Perhaps this book talks us about the regional lens through which regional or local actors view the major issues of the Cold War and understand and perceive them, and they try to integrate them in their own national strategy. Mm-hmm. The third point, everybody has touched this, Cold War modernization. I think this is a book about Cold War modernization. These countries, the Balkan countries, had aspired to enter modernity since the 19th century, but they were not able to achieve it, at least not to achieve it completely. They managed to do it, bumping on this wall and on the other wall, true, but they managed to do it during the Cold War period because they were integrated in the Cold War system, namely in the international system. For regime takers, it is very important to have the opportunity to integrate in the international system, not to remain isolated or outside the system. So they had failed to enter modernity when they could not integrate, but by becoming parts of the Cold War, and the Cold War is not only strategy, there are two projects for modernization there. One of them failed. One of them did not make it, yes. But if we were living in the 1960s, nobody would know about this. Mm-hmm. And please allow me to say that in the 1960s, there are many people who might claim that the other model might be more successful than what Arne Westad has described excellently about the problem of the appeal of the Western capitalist system, which is, as he wrote, a series of unheroic actions which were not always able to inflame the intellectuals of underdeveloped societies, such as the Balkans were. Now, partial disagreement with my friend Veselin. What was the long-term impact of the Cold War in the Balkans? Well, of course, we would all agree, I think, is that we don't know, because we're still living through this post-Cold War period. But allow me to say this, whether the Cold War had permanent consequences on the Balkans. Often when I teach, I ask my students in Greece, what region lies beyond Greece's eastern borders? They become confused sometimes because they cannot place Turkey within a wider region, but they usually reply the Middle East. And then I ask them, what kind of an east is this which starts from its middle? Why we have Europe, and then immediately the Middle East, and then a Far East? And then I have the opportunity to explain them that in previous periods of history there was another region, the Near East, to which Greece and the Balkans belonged. And that region was effectively partitioned through nationalism, through the Industrial Revolution, and through the Cold War. And a part of that region, a part of that old Near East, including effectively the Balkan part, became Europeanized. They became anchored in the developed world. Whether we will remain anchored in the developed world, well, this is for the future to show and for us to accomplish. So these are my points.
Thank you. We have hoped or envisioned to for this to be a conversation about the book, as I said in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And in the commentaries from our commentators and also from my colleagues, co-editors, you could have heard more questions than responses. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the most positive features of this book, that it hopes to inspire further research and search for interpretations and understanding insights into the not just the region but also through the region and through the perhaps the experience and the length, the wider context and the history of Europe and beyond. So I would like to, as we have already gone through a good part of the planned evening, I will try to limit myself to just playing the role of the coordinator of this panel. But I would like to invite you to pose the questions based on this very insightful but also intriguing questions that were posed by the commentators. For you to comment, although you have not yet had the chance, and I hope you will read the book, had chance to read it, but based on these commentaries, on these questions, on these insights, for example, for us to discuss in the next 15, 20 minutes perhaps. So I'm sure all of us would be very happy to respond and to engage in a discussion on the issues that you find of interest. So
we also want to hear a bit of your views, so maybe you could connect this up to when we respond to some of the questions, because you'll be more important than anyone else in putting all of this together.
Thank you, but I really, as all of us are here, and particularly my colleagues, co-editors, eager to hear the feedback from the public, and in particular the view or the starting points, as both Constantina and Avantis very well placed and put forward. What is it that we tried to achieve, and what were the starting positions that we sort of embarked on in our work on this volume? So I'd like to open up the floor for your questions or comments. Yes.
So at the very beginning, Professor Westad talks about Bulgaria's unique position of benefiting from the Soviet model in its post-Cold War development. And I kind of want to ask the inverse question, in a way. Do you think there are any detrimental effects on post-Cold War development, politically, economically, and socially, for nations who are aligned with the West, which Soviet-aligned Balkan states managed to actually avoid?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Do you want us to? Well, I could, of course... This is really a Greek question, in a way, I guess. So I should leave to... It's a Turkish question, but it's more in its current form, maybe more of a Greek question. No. Yeah. So I was speculating about this. I was thinking about it, actually, as I wrote this, the afterword to the book. And I do think that in structural terms, what your question implies is probably, to some extent... At least it points to some of the issues that are there, that are continuing. And this goes to the core, actually, of something that Evantis has written fantastically well about in the past in his book on Greece and NATO, or Greece and the West in the 50s and 60s. That it is in a way that Greece's introduction into the West, West in here in double quotation marks, because we're talking about the military alliance, and then eventually we're talking about economic integration through the EC and the European Union. The way that process happened was very much influenced by the security circumstances, the specific security circumstances of the Balkans. I mean, in this sense, the Balkan issue actually makes sense, because it was a reflection first of the Balkans, and then in a way it was Mediterraneanized, which is a term that I like to use about this. So it became a broader, slightly different focus later on. Whatever way you see that, it obviously had an influence in terms of overlooking some of the structural challenges that Greece had on its way to modernity. There was a need to fast forward this approach, which, of course, in my view, reached the peak of its challenges, if not its folly. You know, when we get to the 2000s in the post-Cold War period. But let's leave that aside for now. So obviously, I do think there were challenges of this kind. Now the big question, and you know, we can deal with this now, we can deal with it later. And Constantina mentioned this, is of course with regard to Turkey. So to what extent should we now actually look at a process that is a little bit similar within Turkey, that some of the current schism, which is very severe and may have very severe consequences for the country, had its origins in some of the things that were more or less brushed under the carpet, you know, in the latter stages of the Cold War in Turkey. So, but I mean, two of you will have more to say on this.
Which ones do you mean?
Which question are they? Well, I was going to say perhaps Greece and Turkey were the best examples, but I mean in any state that was aligned to the West around the world.
No. Well, what were the challenges that Bulgaria did not face, and Greece or Turkey faced? I mean, what is the difference, in other words, between the relationship of Bulgaria to the Soviet Union and Greece to the United States? I mean, the question was whether Bulgaria's relationship to the Soviet Union protected it from certain things that the Greece or Turkey's relationship to the United States did not protect them. And that was effectively the question, was it not? Mm. Which things?
Mm. Well, I guess in terms of economic post-war development, we've talked about the economic crisis that's lasted the war. I guess when we've discussed, for example, Mediterranean states joining the MCC in the 80s, in terms of strategically fast tracks, and Greece, and you have those kind of patterns of economic crisis, Italy's the next sort of discussed.
In terms of
states aligned with the Soviet Union, I don't just mean Bulgaria, but were there any other states that didn't have those same challenges of post-Cold War?
Even with this experience of a very long crisis, and I fear that the longevity of the crisis should not be attributed only to the others, but also to the Greeks, mostly to the Greeks, the longevity of the crisis. I still think that Greece has benefited, is the major, the country which has benefited more than any other Balkan country. From the Cold War period. There is a book, an old book, 1978. It is written by somebody, I will not say that he is the greatest historian of all times, I would say that he is one of the greatest historians of all times, from the ancient Greece to the present, William McNeill, The Metamorphosis of Greece Since World War II, 1978. And there he speaks about a society which is radically transformed in the post-war period, which enters modernity, which becomes, well, in 1978 it was not a rich society, but when the crisis came it was very rich. It was among the 30 richest countries in the world. Now we're 35th. Okay, we've lost. It's not good, I assure you. It's not good. And there are some dark sides on it. But still, just imagine where this country started in 1950. In 1950, if we were to bet our money, what Greece will do in the next period, and the previous 30 years were years of disaster, losing the war with Turkey, bankruptcy in 1932, dictatorship in 1936, triple occupation in the Second World War, hyperinflation, deaths for famine, and then civil war. Now, if in 1950, if I had asked you to bet your money, you would have bet, probably, and I would have bet, that Greece would go on destroying itself. It was a failed state. And then it became one of the most successful examples in the world. Now, we have lost some of this progress, true, but we're still very much, I would say, in a... History has been, fate has been very much better to us than to Bulgaria. And we need to be realistic enough to understand it.
Thank you. Other questions?
May I add something to that?
I misunderstood you. Sorry.
Just a very brief comment. I think none of the Balkan countries followed the tempo of modernization of the superpowers and the more developed countries of the regions. But within the Cold War, they all benefited. And what I also tried to say was that they all became pro-status quo. That was not evident in the Balkans. That was an old schism that the Cold War came to remedy. And some countries had more difficulty in accepting that policy, like Bulgaria, for instance, whereas Greece saw the Cold War and Turkey as a means to secure the gains of the past, the war gains of the past, because nationalism was not... Yeah. Something that happened very far away in the past. It was fresh, and those countries were created out of local nationalism. So I think that what happened after the Cold War has also to do with the idea of modernization in the West as a whole. The system changed. It wasn't the Keynesian economics anymore, the economics anymore. We had a different tempo, an upscale of tempo, and in that many countries could not follow suit. But we cannot compare what would have happened, what if the Soviet Union still existed, what kind of dissonance we would have seen between Bulgaria and the Soviet Union, or Romania and the Soviet Union, and so on. Perhaps there's only one country that is quite different from the others, and perhaps Samuel Huntington is laughing from his grave, namely Turkey, where you have different problems that do not have to do with modernization only, but also with the religious issues, with Islam and fundamentalism in that area. But this is a different story.
Well, perhaps I could also say a few words. I think there is something fundamental in what you say, but it probably comes out more clearly if you compare Greece to the former communist countries in Central Europe, than if you compare it to Bulgaria. I think in the Central European cases, countries like Poland and Hungary or Slovakia, which had been relatively backward before the Second World War, the Soviet model of modernization, with an emphasis on industry and technological progress, worked relatively well during the Cold War, and after the Cold War became the basis for a very successful integration of those countries into the European systems of industrial production. I mean, the reason why Hungary, Poland, Slovakia have done rather well, even during the crisis, is because they have tied their fate to Germany. They have become part of the German system of industrial production, and they have exported their way out of the crisis. Now, if you compare them to Greece, you would see that, for example, in 1989, Greece had a GDP per capita that was probably twice as high as that of Poland. Now, the two are converging very rapidly. So I think those cases would demonstrate that the Soviet model of modernity did have a number of strengths during the Cold War, and in the countries that made the transition after 1989 successfully, after the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Now, Bulgaria, unfortunately, is a country that did not manage to make the transition after 1989 particularly successfully, certainly not as successfully as Poland, Hungary, and Slovakia. So I think that is one of the reasons why it has done relatively badly. But I think in fundamental terms, there is something in what you say, and I think that brings to the fore the importance of open-minded comparisons of alternative models of modernity and how they manifested themselves in not simply in different geopolitical environments, but also in different economic systems.
Well, may I say something else? I'm sorry. Well, may I remind you that one of the reasons for the grave problems of Eastern European countries in the 1970s and mostly in the 1980s was indebtedness, which is the problem of Greece. They had it before Greece.
But they have overcome it.
Yes, they overcame.
They have overcome it.
Well, it is the question is who is able to overcome it.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, talking about winners or losers.
Yes. They change places.
Yes.
Yes. I'd also like to mention something and argue against what is probably very obvious. When you talk about losers, everyone has said that Yugoslavia is the loser with the end of the Cold War. Mm. But I'd like to argue against it. A number of reasons. One is that Yugoslavia gained so much through the Cold War. And one should not forget that in the early 70s, just before Greece applied for the membership of the EEC, the GDP of Yugoslavia was higher than that of Greece. One should also not forget that even parts of Yugoslavia that are perceived to have been more developed, like Slovenia and Croatia, prior to 1939, were underdeveloped, very underdeveloped parts of Europe. So through Yugoslavia, even those parts that were considered developed really benefited as parts of this country. Yugoslavia itself, through the Cold War, and as I would argue, up to the end of 1980s, just before its collapse,
absolutely,
was the beneficiary of the Cold War system.
Yes.
It collapsed overnight. And in 1990, the economic situation in Yugoslavia was one of the best in Eastern Europe, and by far, except for Greece, in the Balkans. At the same time, when you're talking about beneficiaries, we can talk about the country's successors to Yugoslavia. We talk about Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, and so forth, that to this day remain beneficiaries of the system. Talking also about the legitimacy, about the statehood with regard to Slovenia and Croatia that did not have it and did not possess it prior to the creation of Yugoslavia, which was, you know, in confirmed post-Second World War, and Montenegro, which lost its statehood with 1918 and so forth. So in many respects. But here is where the interesting part comes in. And these are some of the questions that in this volume we try to approach. And as you will see, this is a volume of 16 contributions presented through five themes that deal with the creation of the Cold War, the early Cold War, the relations with the superpowers, the military alliances. But then also something which I think personally is an achievement of this book, that we looked at what Constantina mentioned before, a silver lining, the question of identity. And it talks about the dilemmas. Dilemmas of the 70s, 80s are very much not just related to EEC membership economically, but also the issue of dilemma of identity. Mm-hmm. And the theme on ideology, culture, and identity, where we talk on focused, where the contributions are focused on this issue. And to me, when you talk about winners of losers and about Yugoslavia, is something that Yugoslavia best represented, or the collapse of Yugoslavia confirmed as something that was mentioned earlier. And that is the issue of identity in the region. It is also the issue that is very much connected to the question of modernization. Mm-hmm. It's a question of the issue that is very much related to what Arnim called the mystery of the Balkans, and Veselin questioned as the issue of whether it existed at all. And this is something that is a silver lining, not just in the history of the Cold War Balkans, but something from the early 19th century, and persists to this day. Mm. And the issue of the collapse of Yugoslavia is very much, in my opinion, a case study that opens up the question of how to define. And it is something that has been set up in this region for the very simple reason, in my opinion, or that it is a region at the crossroads. It is the multi-ethnic, multinational, multicultural region. It has in the 19th century, the late 19th century, it existed as the Near East. When you talk about the crisis 1877, 1878, it was a crisis in the Near East.
Yeah.
No one spoke of the Balkans. Mm. And to me, why this is important, why I have underlined it, is because I think perhaps, and talking about the legacy, or the post-Cold War legacy, and the impact and so forth, is something that is now as important and as pertinent and as much on the agenda as it was during the Cold War or immediately after the Cold War. Any other questions?
So,
yes, sir.
Do you think, if you compare the efforts of the Soviet Union and the United States, these modernization projects in the Balkans, with the European Union's modernization projects in the Balkans, what lessons are there from the Cold War?
Yeah.
Thank you. Who would like to start first? Antis or Constantina, who wrote the chapter on on the issue. Would you like to start? Where to start?
What lessons are there to be learned? Mm. In the Cold War, we had two federators, the Soviet Union and the U.S. We don't have a federator in the NEC.
Yes.
And the target is different. The security dimension was very important in the Soviet Union. Mm. The security target of the European Union is outposted. Mm. It belongs to NATO. Mm. And it doesn't really go through the development, modernization, and prosperity ideal. Mm. Or perhaps, to be more frank, monetary ideal that the Euro project is creating within the European project right now, and it's doubtful where this is going to lead us. There are many differences. The world and the relations between the countries that participate in this project differ very much from what the situation used to be in the Cold War. Mm. And I think coherence of this new bloc that we call the junior partner of the U.S. within the Western world is much less than it used to be within the monoliths in the beginning and later on within the alliances of the Cold War. But definitely the European project lacks many of the qualities that both the American and the Cold War projects had and made them successful during a long period of time.
I fully agree with Constantina, but let me just add one or two thoughts. The United States intervened, and the Soviet Union, they intervened in the Balkans at a different time when the problems were partially or even radically sometimes different. They intervened and they tried to achieve reconstruction after a world war. This is a huge undertaking, but it is relatively easy because the natural thing after a war is for life to return to normal. It was not easy. The Americans and the Soviets, especially the Americans, I mean, with the Marshall Plan, I still believe that the Marshall Plan was the winning move of the Americans in the Cold War, in the whole Cold War. It created the West. Initially, the idea of the Soviet system, including in the Balkans as well, until the 1950s, it was regarded as much more successful as a shortcut to development. I was reading the minutes of the Greek Parliament, 1964, when the relationship between the two countries was fully normalized. And the Greek deputies of all political persuasions, including right-wing deputies, were mentioning, look what the Bulgarians have done, because the list of Bulgarian goods were industrial goods, and the list of the Greek goods which were going to be exchanged were mostly agricultural products. This is not a picture of the 1980s. It has been reversed immediately. So the Soviet Union and the United States create their worlds at a time when, it's a huge undertaking, but it can be done. Now, the EC intervenes in the Balkans and in the Mediterranean at a later stage. 1970s onwards, and of course, all the things that Constantina mentioned, I fully agree. It is looser. It does not have the certainties of the United States and the Soviet Union. A certain measure of certainty is important to exercise leadership. I may sound a bit realistic or traditionalist, but this is how things are working. The second thing is that the European Union, it intervenes, the European community, it develops a relationship with Yugoslavia in order to stabilize it in the 70s. It makes its southern enlargement in order to stabilize Greece, Portugal, and Spain within the West. Yes, but all these are in the post-industrial era. It's a different era in world history. I'm not trying to evade the question. I'm just saying that issues are much more complicated. In the end of the day, I think that it was successful. I mean, many things did not work in Yugoslavia, of course. But when I think about the impact of the intervention of the European community and the European Union in the Mediterranean and in the Balkans, I would say that it is hugely successful. Perhaps not as successful as I would like it to be in certain respects. Okay, but, you know, it can happen.
Yes, I very much agree with Constantina that the Soviet and American models of development were in many respects much more powerful and effective than the European Union model of development. To the mechanisms that Constantina and Tevantis mentioned, I would add two more mechanisms, which I think were of critical importance in explaining quite why the American and the Soviet developmental models or projects were so successful. I think the first one was ideology. I think what what was at the core of both projects, which what brought all the elements together, focused them like a laser, was ideology. This is something that we lack in the case of the European Union. The second mechanism, which was important, was the party political mechanism. What the Soviet Union and less obviously the United States were able to do was to establish extremely strong links with local political actors based on party political allegiance. Now, this meant that local actors could act much more effectively, knowing that they have this superpower behind them. The European Union has not been able to establish such strong links with local actors, certainly not through party political mechanisms. Of course, in a competitive democracy, it is not easy to establish and sustain party political mechanisms. In the Cold War, that was possible, clearly in the communist cases, but also in Greece and Turkey, which were only imperfectly democratic until, in the Greek case, until the 1970s, in the Turkish case, on and off until the end of the Cold War. So, yes, I think limited democracy had the virtue of making it possible for the superpowers to link themselves extremely strongly with a coherent group of local actors and act together in synchrony to promote a particular developmental project and to overcome the many problems that any developmental project inevitably encounters. The European Union does not have such a mechanism. It cannot even establish such a mechanism given the kind of institution it is, which is not primarily a political institution, and given the fact that in the Balkans, for better or worse, we do have competitive democracies. Turkey is now becoming a partial exception to the rule, but everywhere else we have competitive democracies, which makes it very difficult to sustain any coherent strategy. We can see that in Greece since 2008. And so that, I think, is important.
I'd like to add also from my side something, Roham. And I agree with what has been said, and slightly would disagree with what Veselin had mentioned when he talked about ideology. I think it's hugely important when we look at what period of the Cold War we're talking about. I think this is paramount. On one hand, up to 1970s, one can talk about the prevalence of ideology, and in this, indeed, you know, EEC lacking, as Veselin said, ideological component was not an alternative in a sense. But then when we talk into the 70s and 80s, in a sense, post-ideological era for the Eastern Europe, where things started developing in a different way. This is where the allure of EU or EEC became very strong, and as an option. It is very interesting then that the country basically that persisted in looking through the ideological eyes was Yugoslavia. In many ways it rejected approaches by EEC at the time in early 70s and so on account of the ideological identity that it ascribed to the EEC. Being a non-aligned country, it did not wish to be seen as aligned with the West through EEC and so forth. And this adds to or underlines what I think is very important. Periodization and what decade are we looking at when we talk about the appeal of the Soviet model, American model, or the EEC model that comes into play? Okay, I think we have spent enough time, and I hope that the questions that I'm very grateful to our members of the audience have inspired further deliberations and thinking about some of the issues or themes that are being addressed or asked through questions in this volume, and talking about the Balkans and the issues that are not pertinent just to the Balkans but are much wider importance. And I have the pleasant duty, as someone who has been asked to coordinate this panel, to say a few thanks at the end. I'd like first to thank Arne, who found the time in his very busy schedule that I know these days on visits back to the UK and LSE to come here and contribute to our conversation here, and also to his contribution, which is really invaluable, and my co-editors, I'm sure, will agree with him. And we have really asked him, because of his expertise and being, in my opinion, the Cold War, the historian of the Cold War today, to contribute with the conclusive remarks to the volume. And I'm very grateful for this and for his contribution today. I also wish to thank Veselin Dimitrov, who unfortunately, due to circumstance, could not contribute. And a chapter that was waiting for him, and I'm very sorry, but then I'm sure he will find time for maybe next volume on the Balkans post-Cold War, which I think is something that needs also to be written and presented. But thank you so very much for your insightful comments and for the questions, which are inspirational. I would also like to thank all our contributors. It wasn't easy. It took a lot of time. And I think without them, without their insight, without their research, without their views, without their contributions, this volume would be impossible. And I wish to use this opportunity on behalf of my colleagues to thank all our contributors for their invaluable contribution. We'd like to thank series editors, Effie Pedaliu and John Young, who gave us a chance, opportunity to present this volume in their series. Our publishers, Palgrave Macmillan, for their help and assistance and their patience. It took a long time for this book to materialize. I like to thank again Ideas for organizing and making this possible here today. I'd like to thank my dear friends, co-editors, Konstantina Evantis and Irini, for the years of unique experience working together, staying friends and becoming even closer friends after this experience. Of course we argued, of course things could turn dicey, but that's a process, a creative process. Without it is impossible. But I think one of the nicest things is that we remain and became even closer friends, and I hope that we will together continue working on projects in future. And finally, I wish to thank you for really making this occasion a special occasion for all of us, and finding time on Friday evening to participate in our conversation. And I hope this will, together with the insights that provided by our commentators, provide for a chance for another discussion on issues that are perhaps emanate or can be related to the Balkans, but are wider significance and importance. So once again, on behalf of my colleagues, co-editors, and all of us here, thank you very much for coming tonight and participating in this event.